Good evening, everybody. It's nice to be with you. I've been in this church once before. Spoke here, I think it was about 3 years ago or so. So it's nice to be back. Grateful to you all for inviting me to be here with you this evening. I moved to Maine 2 years ago from Florida. I'd lived in Florida for 30 years. Never liked the weather in Florida. It took me a long time to get out of there, but I finally did. But everywhere I go these days, people talk about weather. People's weather is really messed up. It's very strange. It's doing things it didn't used to do in local communities. Just a few years ago, one of my friends sent me this link to a website, an Air Force website. It was called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. And it talks about how the Pentagon has been and will continue to be trying to change weather, to use weather as a battlefield weapon around the world. The Pentagon's been working on directed energy weapons to direct energy at the ionosphere so they can lift the ionosphere to change weather around the world. And when you start lifting the ionosphere, friends, I believe you set in motion a chain reaction that has severe implications for the entire planet. And so is it not possible that the strange weather fluctuations around the world today are being caused, at least in part, by this Pentagon weather modification experimentation? And so the militarists and the industrialists and the scientists are literally playing God with the creation, thinking that they have the power of God to change the way this universe was created. And I would submit to you that those people are out of control, just like the Bush administration and the Congress are out of control today, and that we, the people, have to intervene in order to protect the future generations, in order to protect this planet, the Mother Earth, the sacred Mother Earth. We, the people, have to intervene to stop these people because they've become a danger. Like juvenile delinquents run amok in the neighborhood, the time for us as citizens to intervene is here. Celeste said, I grew up in a military family and I worked on Nixon's campaign in 1968 as a young Republican. I did such a good job. I was living up in the panhandle of Florida. So conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama. And I did such a good job, they had this fish fry fundraiser for Nixon. And they asked me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that evening, a guy that died just a couple years ago. You probably all have heard of him, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. So this is how I got my start in politics. And then in 1971, I tried to join the Air Force because that's what I knew. I grew up on military bases. You know, we're all a product of our upbringing in some way or the other, aren't we? You know, I liken it to someone lifts the lid on your head and they pour in and they close the lid and there you are, right? I was trained to be a right winger and that's what I became. And so I tried to join the Air Force, but I flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury. So I had to get a waiver to get into the Air Force when most people of good sense were trying to stay out of the military. And I was sent after my training to a base in California. There was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. I've got a new book. It just arrived from the printer today to my office called Come Together Right Now, Organizing Stories from a Fading Empire. And I want to read to you a little bit about my first day at the induction center in Oakland, California. I had to report for my induction physical at the Oakland, California Center. Long lines of new recruits stood outside the induction center waiting for the doors to open. A middle-aged woman was working the line, pleading with each of us not to go into the military. Her son had been killed in Vietnam, she wailed. Her mournful cries cut right to my gut and were followed by more appeals from a young black man who had no face, no ears, no nose, just holes in his head surrounded by a burnt, scarred face. That told me more about the horror of the war in Vietnam. And so after I was through my basic training, I was sent to Travis Air Force Base. And the first day when I checked into the barracks, they looked down this long list of rooms and they said, "Oh my God, we've only got one room left. We'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Get your bags. Follow me," the guy says. And we go down this long, dark hallway, last door on the left. And he kept saying, "Really, we'll get you out of here as soon as we can." And I thought it would be a little broom closet with a cot, and I'd stay in there a couple nights. But he opened the door, and there were anti-war posters all over the wall. As it turned out, it was one of the leading GI resistance movement organizers in the barracks. They were keeping him isolated because they were trying to kick him out, but they didn't have enough goods on him yet. But then they ran out of rooms. And so they put me in there, and then they forgot completely about me. So a couple nights a week, there would be a knock on the door. And GIs would bring chairs into the room, arrange them in a circle, light up some joints, and begin talking about Vietnam. I sat in the corner in sheer terror. Communists, pot smokers, cursing our government and our President Nixon. I didn't know what to do, but I stayed there and listened. Another night, there was a knock on the door, and it revealed black GIs from the cities, members of the Black Panthers talking about racism. It didn't take me long to begin to inch my chair into the circle in my new barracks room. The things these GIs were saying, even though much of it was new to me, made sense. I began reading their books, and I began smoking their pot. So after I got out of the Air Force, I was going to college, and I was just ready to graduate from the University of Florida, and I got recruited by the United Farm Workers Union to become an organizer of fruit pickers in Florida. And so I quit college to become a union organizer, and I've been organizing ever since. I never graduated college, thank God. Well, I want to talk to you tonight about America, and I want to talk to you about the soul of America, if I can be so presumptuous. To understand, I think, where we are as a nation today and where we're going tomorrow, I think we have to go back and look at the cloth, the fabric of America. Let's think of America as a piece of cloth. And let's look at the strands that wove this cloth together. From the first day, the creation of America, the slaughter of the genocide of the native people, the introduction of slavery in America. I would submit to you that the early strands of the cloth of America were strands of violence and warfare. Now, this is not to say that every single person in America was bad, or that there weren't good-hearted people and people of progressive vision, because there always were. But let's be honest about the creation story of America. And then we go to the American Revolution, to that famous place, Valley Forge. You remember where the soldiers were huddled at the time of the Revolution in that cold winter, freezing and starving and no weapons to speak of, and almost a defeat, and George Washington riding into camp on his white horse, imploring the revolutionary soldiers to hang on. Hang on, we'll pay you when the war's over. Hang on, let's just beat King George. Get rid of the empire. You remember that. But what you don't know and what we don't learn in the history books is that the contractors had been paid by the Continental Congress to provide for the Revolutionary Army. But the contractors stole clothes, the blankets, the guns. They ripped off the Congress in corruption. And then after the war, when the Constitution was created that said white men with property can vote, and these people went back, these soldiers went back to their lives, most of them peasants, didn't own land, were not going to be able to vote in this new revolutionary America. But some of them did own land. They were small farmers, and they went back to their farm expecting to participate in this new democracy. But what happened was that they found the new Congress immediately imposed new taxes whiskey tax and other taxes on them so that they could no longer afford to own their land because they were never paid by the Congress for their time in the army. And so they had a rebellion, Shays' Rebellion in western Massachusetts, where they said, "We've been betrayed. We have a new king. We fought for this revolution, and now it has abandoned us." And Shay and others were hung by George Washington's army because they dared rebel against this new government. And then we go forward to the late 1860s, at the time of the great Indian Wars out in the Dakotas. You all know the story of Crazy Horse, one of the great warriors who led the Lakota people to victory at the Battle of the Little Bighorn against Custer, that presumptuous white man who thought he was going to destroy the native savages. What you don't know, though, is for years, over about 20-year period of time, the army was brought in to chase the Indians throughout this sacred land, the Pahasapa, the heartbeat of the continent they called the Black Hills, the native people did. They were given this land in a treaty, told that as long as the grass grew green, the Black Hills would belong to them. But then gold was discovered in the Black Hills. And so the army was brought in to clear the Indians out so the white man could go in and take control. And so for 20-some years, the Indians were chased down and hunted down and brought onto the reservations where they were promised they would be taken care of as long as the grass grew green. They would be provided with blankets and food and taken care of forever if they gave up their way of life. But Crazy Horse was one of the last to go onto the reservation. Him and Sitting Bull, they fought and they fought and they fought until their people were dying of starvation because the buffalo were gone. The antelope, the deer, the elk were gone. And so Crazy Horse even finally had to submit to going onto the reservation. And the deal was, you give up your guns and you give up your horses. Their entire way of life. Give up your guns and your horses. You move on to the reservation and we'll feed you forever. So against their own better judgment, they did it. And onto the reservation they went. And what they soon found was that the corporations were stealing from them. The corporations had money appropriated by Congress to feed the Indians. But when they would give them the blankets, they were made of such thin cloth, they wouldn't keep them warm during the winter. And the bacon was rancid by the time it was given to the Indians. And the flour had bugs in it. And so the Indians were starving. And they didn't even have guns and horses so they could go hunt to feed their people on the reservation. But then the corporation said, you know what? This peace is really not very profitable. When we had the war going on with the Indians, we were making enormous profits. So they sent their public relations people out all over America to fabricate stories in the American newspapers saying that Crazy Horse and his band had gone back on the warpath, and they had artists do renderings of the savages killing white women and children on their farms throughout the Dakota territories, when in fact Crazy Horse was inside of his teepee on the reservation without a gun and a horse to his name. And what I would submit to you, that the corruption of the military-industrial complex is endemic in America. It is deep in the roots of this nation. It is deep in the fabric of the cloth of America. So that today when we see the corruption of Halliburton and Bechtel in Iraq, stealing from the American people, not outfitting the GIs who were sent to die for the oil corporations in Iraq, it is more of the same. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an FBI agent because I wanted to fight organized crime. And so I took a correspondence course when I was about 12 or 13 or 14. And I learned about fingerprints. Everybody has a fingerprint. And I learned definitions. And one I'll never forget, modus operandi, M.O. Every criminal has an M.O. And what I would submit to you is that the military-industrial complex has an M.O. And they are operating us right now in the same way they've been doing for hundreds of years in this country. And now today, that same military-industrial complex views space as the new market. The next round of the arms race. The Pentagon brags that Star Wars will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, necessitating such an expense that they will have to defund social progress in America to pay for it. I subscribe to a couple of the aerospace industry publications. One of them is called Space News. In an editorial a couple years ago, they said, you know, we have to be responsible corporate citizens. We have to identify a funding source if we hope to be successful. And so we have. We're sending our lobbyists to Washington to defund the entitlement programs. Now, friends, what is the official definition of the entitlement programs? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got through with it. These are the programs that the military-industrial complex has identified that they will defund in order to pay for the next arms race that is going to be in the heavens, and education, and clean water, and clean air. These are the programs, all, that they will go after. So friends, today I would submit to you that we are all the Indians who are going to be brought on to the reservation. I call Star Wars pyramids to the heavens. The aerospace corporations are the new pharaohs of our age, building these pyramids to the heavens. And we, the taxpayers, will be the slaves to turn over everything we have, social progress and all, our hopes and dreams for our children's future, in order to pay for their program to arm the heavens. This is one of the planning documents of the United States Space Command called Vision for 2020. And in this planning document, the Space Command says that we, the United States Space Command, will control space, we will dominate space, and we will deny other countries access to space. And on their headquarters building at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, they have their slogan, their logo that reads right over the door, Master of Space. And they wear it as a patch on their uniform. I like to call it Master of Disaster. And so the American people, in order to be brought into line, just like the American people had to be lied to about Crazy Horse going out on the warpath again, a public relations campaign created. What's the public relations campaign for Star Wars? How do they sell that to us today? How do they get us to turn over the national treasury? The rogue states, Iraq, has weapons of mass destruction, is going to attack the United States. And so we have to have missile defense. A bullet hit a bullet in deep space in order to protect us from attack by Iraq, who, as it turned out, had zero weapons of mass destruction. Iran is going to attack us with weapons of mass destruction. And we're going to have to go in and do a preemptive first strike attack on Iran, because if they get nuclear weapons, they're going to attack us. We'll have to have missile defense protect us. Iran today has zero weapons of mass destruction. North Korea. North Korea is going to attack us with weapons of mass destruction. Today, North Korea has zero nuclear weapons capable of hitting the continent of the United States, the west coast of the United States. Zero nuclear weapons. And now China is thrown in into the rogue state equation. And China admittedly has 20 weapons of mass destruction capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. While we, the United States of America, the good guys, we have over 7,500 of our own nuclear weapons, what I call an arsenal of hypocrisy, as we lecture the rest of the world that you cannot have nuclear weapons, but as we go and build new generations of nuclear weapons and build space weapons, and the rest of the world looks at us and says, who do you think you are fooling? Who do you think you are? So missile defense is a Trojan horse. It is used to frighten the American people and to sell the program to the American people, when in fact it has nothing at all to do with defense. It's about offense. It's about controlling space. It's about dominating space. And it's about denying other countries access to space. It's about the United States becoming the master of space. On the back cover of this vision for 2020, there's the Earth sitting on a pedestal. And the words above it are, "Space, the warfighter's edge." What the American people don't know is that when we did the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, 50 military satellites based in Colorado coordinated the entire attack. 70% of the weapons that were used on Iraq were directed to their targets by space satellites. 70%. So no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, on a plane, on a boat, whatever, all modern warfare today is coordinated by satellite technology. So whoever controls space controls the Earth. Whoever controls space wins all the wars on the Earth below. Whoever controls space becomes the Ubermeister of the planet. The Space Command is the military arm of corporate globalization. How many of you have heard of a guy by the name of Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of War? He has a guy that is called his strategy guy. He was recently a professor at the Naval War College, Thomas Barnett. He's written a book called The Pentagon's New Map. His job is to go out and teach military transformation to the Pentagon. Military transformation is Donald Rumsfeld's number one job today, even more important than the war in Iraq. So let's talk about what military transformation is and what it means. I saw one night, I'm watching C-SPAN, and I saw Thomas Barnett come on and speak to a room twice this size, loaded with guys in military uniforms with lots of brass on their shoulders, and also top-level CIA people. And Barnett came out and told the assembled that if you expect to get promoted in the new military, you got to learn this transformation ethic, and you have to teach it. Anybody that doesn't go along with it, you're not going to get promoted. And then he revealed it to the audience. He says that because of corporate globalization of the world economy, we're not going to have jobs in America. Why pay somebody $20 an hour to make TVs in America when you can go to China, he said, and pay them a couple dollars a day or less? That doesn't make any sense, right? Corporations are all about maximizing profits. Corporations don't care about country anymore. The New World Order, okay? Corporate globalization. And so every country, he said, under corporate globalization will have a different job, a different responsibility. The number one job of America in the New World Order, he said, will be what he called security export. And he defined it. He said, give me your 18, 19, 20-year-old angry young men who love to play video games. He said, we're going to send them into what he called the non-integrating gap. The non-integrating gap. The part of the world that is resisting corporate globalization. And he identified the non-integrating gap. The Middle East, where today we're fighting in Iraq. Central Asia, where today we have bases in Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, etc. Latin America, where today Venezuela and Chavez is not acquiescing to corporate domination. And Africa, where he said we'll be fighting 20 years from now for their oil. He said, we will forget the old Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine thing. He said, there is no such thing anymore. Because of space technology, everything is coordinated. Everything is what they call net-centric. Everything is tied together through computers. The service differentiations don't mean anything anymore. And one part of transformation, they're trying to wipe that away. He said, we're going to have two basic services. One he called Leviathan. Leviathan, he said, is the kick-ass 18, 19-year-old angry young men going into a part of the world and getting people to submit to the authority of corporate globalization. Leviathan. And he said, instead of the big bases we have in Europe, we're going to close those down and we're going to have tiny little lily pad bases all over the world. Little jumping off bases all over the world where the United States can quickly intervene in a moment's notice to suppress any opposition to corporate globalization. You're going to do it our way or you're going to die. He said, preemption is where it's at. Forget international treaties. We're not going to be held back by them. He said, Hitler never had... Now remember, he's talking to high-level military brass and CIA. Hitler never had to ask for permission to invade anybody, he said, and we won't either. Now if that doesn't send chills down your back, nothing will. That's a quote. I ordered the video from C-SPAN. Go to Thomas Barnett, Google him, go to his website. He has some of the videos of his talks on there. The other, he said, besides Leviathan, which he said we've shown we can successfully do with Iraq. We invaded Iraq, they completely laid down, they rolled over, they ran for the hills. They couldn't fight us, our army is too powerful, he said. But the part we're not doing so well is the other branch of the military. He calls it systems administration, the proconsul of the empire. These troops, he said, will never come home. He said, we have to get better at this. We have to get better that after we've gone in and conquered a territory, we have to get better at administering it. We're not doing so well in Iraq today, he said. And this is something that we must do a better job of. Endless war. That's their vision, their prescription. Endless war. You've all heard that the income gap in America is widening between the rich and the poor. Think of the pyramid. Today at the top of the pyramid are 29,000 people in America. And they own the equivalent wealth of 96 million Americans at the bottom. 29,000 Americans at the top, 96 million Americans at the bottom. That's called an oligarchy. It's not called a democracy. It's called an oligarchy. That's where we are today, friends. And I think as we look for how do we get out from behind the eight ball, the very first thing we have to do is face the reality of where we're at today. And it's not an easy pill to swallow, believe me, for anyone. But that's where we are. So what do we do next? When jobs are moving overseas, and we have less and less jobs in America, and they want to put us in this state of endless war to control the oil of the world, to control the water of the world. The oil in Iraq, that's not oil that we use in America. We get our oil from Canada, from Venezuela. The oil in Iraq goes to China. And the United States knows that if we can control the Iraqi oil, we control the key to the Chinese economic engine. That's what the war in Iraq is all about. And today, on the inland border of China, go home and look at a map. And what you'll see are the countries called the stands. Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. These are the countries that we are now occupying because of 9/11. The pretext to go in and move our military into a region that during the Cold War we would have gone to nuclear war with Russia and China over had we tried to do an invasion of that part of the world. But now because of 9/11 we have successfully occupied the inland border of China, the southern border of the former Soviet Union. In the former Soviet Union, we're in there now with bases. Last month, the president of Kyrgyzstan had his troops mow down 500 democracy protesters in the street. 500 of them killed in the street. And the United States didn't say a word. Why? Because today, the president of Kyrgyzstan is allowing the U.S. to build a new Star Wars radar facility in Kyrgyzstan on China's border. that will help direct this whole Star Wars program, because you need these little radar facility downlink stations around the Earth to communicate with the satellites, to send signals back and forth, to tie the whole Star Wars program together. And so we're surrounding China on its inland border, and now we're moving to deploy Aegis destroyers outfitted with so-called missile defense systems on China's coastal region in Japan and South Korea, Taiwan, 90 miles off the coast of mainland China. We're going to do an encirclement of China because we will surround China. In a Washington Post story of May of 2000 entitled "For the Pentagon, Asia Moving to the Forefront," the Washington Post reported that the Pentagon is now today doubling our military presence in the Asian Pacific region. We're lengthening and widening the runways on Guam and Wake Island in the Pacific to handle the B-1 and B-2 bombers. We've already pre-positioned cruise missiles on Guam. And now we're moving to deploy Aegis destroyers who would take out those 20 nuclear missiles of China by being right on their coast. And China now today, if you really listen in America, China today is being created as the new enemy of the American people. If you really listen, you'll hear it. The Indians are on the warpath because they have the audacity to challenge us economically around the world. As long as we were controlling people all over the world, as long as we were buying everything up all over the world, it didn't matter. That was fine. That was good capitalism. But now China has given us a dose of our own medicine, and they're evil for doing it, and we're going to have to go to war with them. I was listening just 2 weeks ago to a congressional hearing in the Congress about the Unocal sale, possibly China trying to buy Unocal, and people testifying to Congress that we were going to have to go to war with China soon over these things because they were getting too big for their britches. Imagine the profits that could be made by the military-industrial complex by doubling our military presence in the Asian Pacific region to prepare for war with China. Enormous. Just to illustrate the point, you remember a couple years ago, a spy plane, American, Lockheed Martin, EP-3, lumbering, slow, propeller-driven spy plane, reconnaissance plane, bumping up along the coast of mainland China. And two Chinese fighters were dispatched, and they went up along and they bumped into it, and they brought it down on the Hainan Island. Now, first of all, if the United States wanted to spy on China, we would just use our satellites. We wouldn't need a slow, lumbering reconnaissance plane that is very easily detected and very easily caught. I would submit to you the United States was trying to create an incident. But then the Chinese brought the plane down and they kept the crew for a few days and sent them back to the United States. And then they went and took the plane apart. They kept all the good stuff. And they put the plane in pieces and crates and sent it back, what was left, to the United States. And now today, guess what? On Hainan Island, Lockheed Martin, the builders of the EP-3, is building a naval reconnaissance system for Communist China so that Communist China can detect the United States military maneuvers in the region. And so Lockheed Martin will make more money the more tensions there are from the rising conflict between the United States and China. A new arms race will benefit Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon on down the line. They're setting it up. Corruption, MO, endemic in the cloth of America. So what's the way out? I think we have to go before the American people and tell the truth. Hello, my name is America, and I'm addicted to war. Hello, my name is America, and I'm addicted to militarism and violence. I believe that America needs to come to grips with its utter addiction to war and violence, an addiction that is part of the very cloth and fabric and makeup of our nation. If anyone doubts me, just look across America today at the local communities that are involved in the BRAC base closing round. And look how local communities all over this country are on their bended knees begging with the Pentagon, please don't close our base down. Please don't close our military production facility down. Please, we'll give you all the tax breaks you can want. Please don't close us down. We are like an alcoholic that has to go to the bar for another drink because our economy is so addicted to military spending. Our number one industrial export as a nation is weapons. And when weapons are your number one industrial export, what is your global marketing strategy? So until we deal with jobs, we're going nowhere. You want to end war? We will never end war. We will never stop war until we deal with jobs. We could stop the Iraq war tomorrow, but I promise you within a year we're going to be in another war because we got to keep the production facilities going, moving, churning out product. I was in Colorado Springs, the home of the Space Command, in April, protesting at the Space Foundation Convention. 6,500 military corporation brought in 500 students from all over the country. 6,500 people, 20 of us outside, holding signs and banners. And I learned that 47% of the people in Colorado Springs work for the military-industrial complex. How are you ever going to end war unless you deal with jobs? How is the peace movement ever going to end war unless we talk about jobs? How do we do that? What do we say? We have to talk about economic conversion. You know, in the 1980s, there was a huge movement growing all over this country like a wildfire. Convert. The Soviet Union was collapsing. We were going to have a peace dividend. We weren't going to need NATO anymore. We were talking about converting the military-industrial complex. And then all of a sudden, in a flash, it was gone. What happened to that movement? Where'd it go? Well, we had an invasion, what King George I called Operation Just Cause. But it was not a just cause. It was an invasion of Panama to go after one bad apple, Manuel Noriega, who had been working for the CIA since the 1950s. And we went in and we burned down the entire El Chorrillo neighborhood, killing over 2,000 innocent civilians, burned the neighborhood to the ground. You want to talk about 9/11? In order to get Manuel Noriega, Operation Just Cause. And then we had the Persian Gulf War. And then suddenly the conversion discussion, the peace dividend, was gone. Well, we can't let that happen again. We've got to talk about jobs. Why is it that at military production facilities all over America, with your hard-earned tax dollars, why can't we build a rail system that will touch every corner of America, rivaling any country in the world, getting us out of our cars, getting us away from oil that is diminishing in supply, that is polluting our ozone, that is creating global warming? Why can't we build a public rail transit system creating millions of jobs across this country? Why can't we, with your hard-earned tax dollars, create a solar power economy that puts a solar water heater on every home and business virtually in this entire nation? Why can't we do that with your money? Think of the jobs it would create in design, manufacturing, installation, repair. Millions of jobs all over America. Why at the military production facilities in America with your hard-earned tax dollars can't we build windmills to be put up all over America to provide wind power, clean, free energy? Why? And I say, if we don't create a political demand all over this nation, it'll never happen. If we don't create a political demand all over this nation, it'll never happen. The people that tell me, well, Bruce, I'm giving up, man. This is all so dark. I feel so powerless. What the hell? These guys, you know, we're going back into feudalism. I give up. Forget it. Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I have a 24-year-old son. And I do not have the right to just give it up for him. Okay? There comes a time in America when you look at the history, as dark as a lot of our history is, there are these brilliant, bright spots through the history of America where movements come and make dramatic changes in this country. And it's when the people are galvanized and speaking with one voice all over the country with courage, with dedication and perseverance and heart. I believe we can create a new America, a new vision for America, if we go and do it and bring our folks, our friends on board. In Copenhagen, Denmark, they've converted a shipyard to become the world's producing place for windmills. Denmark has decided that by the year 2020, they're going to provide 50% of their national energy by wind power. And countries all over the world now are buying windmills from Denmark. And where I live in Maine today, up in northern Maine, there's a windmill farm being constructed that's going to provide electricity for 25,000 homes in the state. And they're going to bring those windmills from Denmark as jobs are moving out of our state by the thousands, as the textile industries move out of Maine, as the shoe industry has moved out of Maine. Even the paper mills are closing down in Maine. They're cutting the timber, taking it overseas to process in third world countries. Why can't we build windmills in Maine for our wind farm in Maine? Why not? I think what we're talking about is the soul of America. And there is a battle going on for the soul of our nation. I want to read to you a quote. See if you can tell me, it's American GI, see if you can tell me what war this GI is talking about, okay? He says this, "I really felt guilty as I applied the torch to huts that were homes of content until we ravagers came spreading desolation everywhere. Our mission here is ostensibly to destroy, but may it not transpire that we pillagers are carelessly sowing the seeds of empire." Anybody know what war that was? Philippines? What was the other? Spanish-American War? Vietnam? Well, actually, it was a veteran of George Washington's army in 1779 as they set out to remove the Iroquois civilization from New York. As Washington and the new American Empire were trying to expand its boundaries westward beyond the Mississippi River, they had a vision. They went to war twice with Canada to try to take the Canadian territories away, but they lost. They did go to war with Mexico and took significant portions of the lands from Mexico to make up the United States. And then from there went on to the Philippines and on, and the rest is history. I want to read to you another quote, more contemporary. Associated Press, 2004, July 16th, from Iraq. Quoting a Captain Will Hickok VI, a relative of the famous Wild Bill Hickok. This Captain Will Hickok in Iraq was stationed with the Army's elite 9th Cavalry Unit, and he said this, "This is what I like, just scouting, sitting out here spying, watching out. It's relaxing. It's almost like playing cowboys and Indians." So friends, I would submit to you that the soul of our nation is broken. As the native people said, the sacred hoop is broken. Think of it as a stick that is broken. The spiritual connection between the human and the Mother Earth. The connection that helps us understand that when we pollute the water, we foul our own nest. And we destroy the chances of life for the next 7 generations or more. The connection to the Mother Earth is broken. And so part of our healing, if you will, part of our peace message has to be a spiritual reconnection of the people. Now, I'm not talking religion here. I'm not talking the Bible. What I'm talking about is our relationship to one another as people and also our relationship to our Mother Earth. That we have to heal this broken connection if we ever hope to change America's way in the world. We have to heal the soul of the people. The sacred hoop is broken. I want to read to you a quote from the Hopi elders who talk about this and give us a way. They give us an idea of how we should proceed as people. They say this: "It is time to speak your truth, each of you. Do not look outside yourself for the leader. There's a river flowing very fast. Trust the river has its destination. You must let go of the shore." To me, what that means, let go of the system, let go of the success mythology that the most important thing is to climb the corporate ladder, to be better than the Joneses next door, to have a better house and job. Let go of the shore. Push off into the river. Keep your eyes open and your heads above the water. See who's in there with you and celebrate. The time of the lone wolf is over. The time of dog-eat-dog culture, of every man for himself, the time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. We are the ones we've been waiting for. I told you I grew up in a military family. My dad was sent to Korea during the Korean War. He was sent to Vietnam. When he came back from Vietnam, we were living up in Fort Walton Beach in the panhandle of Florida. They have a big bombing range there at Eglin Air Force Base. Often they would bomb at night. One night he heard the bombs and he thought he was back in Da Nang in Vietnam, and he jumped under the bed. Well, he, like many people in the military, turned to alcohol in order to heal his broken soul. And he became more violent as the years went on. And I, as a child, throughout my years, I was often beaten by him. And he would sometimes say to me as he was beating me, "This hurts me more than it hurts you." And I used to sort of, you know, laugh at to myself and say, "Yeah, that's what you think." But as I've gotten older, I've come to believe there was some truth in that. And I want to share with you the bit from the closing chapter of my book. Imagine generation after generation of Americans whooping the world's ass in a series of wars, not being fought because the American working class GI wanted to, but because he had to, because they were told to do so by those who ran the country. The whooping often hurt the GIs as much as it hurt those they administered it to. Post-traumatic stress disorder has just become known since the Vietnam War. In earlier wars, GIs were ridiculed when they got battle fatigue or became gun shy. Virtually every family in America has been touched by the trauma of war. These generations of soldiers have come home, most of them never talking about their experiences, and gone on to try to put their lives back together again in a country that did not want to know how they felt. What happens to this pent-up violence inside of these American GIs when they return? They feel guilt, but they've been told they're heroes. So they hold the conflicted feelings inside and they turn on their loved ones, erupting like molten volcanoes. The corporate culture does not care about what they feel. The corporate culture does not want to talk about the pain and suffering of the GIs, because the corporate culture has plans for endless war in order to subdue the world for its benefit. After a while, the proclivity to violence turns to ugly addiction. We as a culture begin to celebrate it and we brag on our prowess. We romanticize the wars and the warriors. We idolize the weapons, and we stand in wonder as the warplanes fly overhead in celebration of our collective insanity. And insanity it is. If you doubt it, just ask some of the people whose countries we have invaded. We must climb out of this deep, dark hole. In order for us to do so, we must first admit our addiction, and then we must get treatment for it. Just like any other addict, we must begin a collective national 12-step program to recover from our passion for war. The peace movement in America is the mirror. We hold up the mirror so the country can gaze into the glass and see what we have become. Most Americans don't want to look. They know what is there. But if they look deeply into the mirror, then they might have to do something about it. And the reality in America is that this is one subject that we don't touch. Domestic violence is always denied by the family. I know all about that. I remember vividly the days after my mother was beaten and I had to walk to school with a heavy heart and no one to share it with. I was taught to keep it quiet, and so we do. I thank God for the peace movement. It has helped me find my way back to some semblance of sanity. It has given me a safe place where I can tell my story to people who deeply care. The peace movement is the conscience of America. We need more of it. Thank you very much.